Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, I'm going to a show at the Songbird. Do you know if they have a dress code?
Oh, yes. It's strictly jacket required.
Poor Sam.
All right, Patrick. Yeah. So, we did this interview
with
Lee Baines.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Baines the third.
Lee Baines the third, right. Yeah. We heard a little bit about Lee Baines 1 and 2 at some point in passing.
Yes, a little bit. Yeah. And we talked with him backstage at Songbird, which is a cool venue in D.C.
Yeah, those folks are really nice. Thank you. They've always been really nice to us and pretty accommodating when we wanted to interview somebody there.
That's right.
So it's pretty cool. Now, I will also like to thank intern Sam because he came along with us and he took some photos and kind of in general had a fun time and hung out. Now, I will say this. You're going to bust on Sam a little bit here. Maybe not, but... you know, it's punk rock, right? It's Lee Baines and Third
yes.
Glory Fire is like dirty, fast punk rock. And Sam had just come from his internship.
Some other internship.
Right?
Not
the
official
ours.
One.
Right, right. Where he gets paid and actually is furthering his life.
Yes.
But he's had his blazer and his khaki pants on and his white shirt. But we tried to get Sam to change his clothes, but he did not want to do that. No.
Just at least take off the jacket, but he wouldn't do it.
No, I'm comfortable.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And he did, and he rocked the show.
He owned it, man. He was right in there the whole time. It was great. So, I don't know. Sam, he's a special guy. I love him very dearly and thank him so much. But I don't know. For me, I would kind of feel uncomfortable, I guess, in my suit jacket.
The kids today.
Yeah,
I know.
It's crazy. The kids today, yeah. Really.
In fact, I remember when I was a kid like Sam, and I was his age, and I would go to a show, say like Black Flag, for example, and the amount of thought I would put into,
oh my God,
what am I going to wear
exactly,
so as not to stand out?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I can't wear that T-shirt. No way.
No.
Yeah, I got to wear something with nothing on it.
That's right. Right. You don't want to
I don't want to look too square. Yeah.
And it would call any attention to myself in any way that might cause any, you know,
so true
interaction with someone I didn't want to interact with.
Right? Yeah. Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Anyway. Okay, this is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lennon.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And if you didn't listen to yesterday's episode, you should go back and do that.
Definitely do that.
Part one of our interview with Lee Baines III of Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires. Yeah. A really cool band you should get to know. And what do you like about them so much?
Well, you know, as kind of like I said yesterday, I love that kind of combination of like searing, you know, punk rock with a little southern edge. And just, I love the way the lyrics kind of continually surprise you the more you listen to it. Plus, there's a lot of songs you can just shout along to.
Yes.
I mean, and we experienced that on the show when he played Good Old Boy and he was like down in the audience, handing the mic to people. I was in there shouting as loud as I could to try to get in there. Yeah.
Right.
So there's a lot of that too. And I don't know, you know, just it's refreshing. There's not a lot of bands really that are kind of working in this kind of style, you know? I mean, I guess maybe you could say at one point that Drive-By Truckers were doing something similar, but they were never as fast and loud, right?
No.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, Jim, I think we talked about this. When my ears ring at a show, that show was very, very loud, and my ears did ring afterwards.
Yeah, it was great.
I liked the volume.
Super intense, and like you said, but yet what I like about it, and I'm probably just repeating a lot of what you said before, but it has that intensity, but there's a certain soulfulness to the music
as well. Yeah, there really is.
And I just like sort of that combination. I also like the fact that, you know, we talk up with Lee about various issues of Southern identity and things like that. And I think there's an unfair sort of stereotype about rock music in the South, too, that I think when people think of Southern rock, they get a certain impression that it's going to be sort of jammy, sort of twangy, you know, that kind of stuff. And while you hear little twinges of things like that in here, that's not really what he's trying to do.
No, not at all. Yeah. And that's really refreshing, too. And like you said, I think yesterday, he owns that Southern identity and it's so important to them. That really makes it cool. I think it's very unique in that sense. And also kind of an up-and-coming band. It's cool to discover an up-and-coming band, you know?
That's always fun.
And there was a decent crowd there, but, you know, so he's really still very much on the way up.
Yes, and the crowd that was there was really into the show.
Man, they were.
And I got to watch Lee sort of interacting with some of his fans at the merch table afterward and see some of the conversations they would have, things like that. And there really was. There was a lot of sort of love going back and
there
forth.
There really was.
The band
wasn't that impressive?
Artist,
so. Yeah. I mean, he drives the van for most of the day to get there. They do a sound check. Then he has to sit there and talk to us for 40 minutes. Then he goes on stage, plays a show. Then he goes and sells all the merch.
Right.
Then they got to pack it up and drive down to Richmond the next night where they were doing two shows. So, yeah, he's just an inspirational dude.
So speaking of the van, you're going to hear a little bit about that this segment of the interview. So let's get to that right now.
So let me, since you brought up Discord bands and your influences, I want to go to another question Doug had here that I thought was really, really interesting. You said at one point you like Big Country's The Crossing, which is a perfect record. What do you think about the follow-up Steel Town, which has some lyrical themes similar to Youth Detention?
Yeah, man, I kind of checked that one out. Yeah. It's weird. Like the lyrics are pretty cool, but the music starts losing me that first one. It's funny, man. It's like those, like Big Country and The Alarm and like early U2. I wasn't really onto that stuff until very recently.
Is that right?
Yeah. And I'm like, man, this is pretty good stuff, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So were you happy with the way Youth Detention came out in sound and execution? Because it is more cohesive and I think it has a more sort of tearing leading edge than the previous records.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I've never worked so hard on anything as I worked on that record from writing the song, but through mixing, man, like, it was just, and I still feel like I owe my soul to the guy, Dave Gardner, who mastered it. Cause even by the, like we wound up mixing it on this, it was a computer from 1999.
Really?
And it like kept crashing and like we had the final mixes and I was like, you know what, man, we need to turn up the kick and snare just a little bit. And our buddy Lynn, who was just, you know, amazing through the whole thing, but he was like, man, she bit the dust finally. Like
it's gone.
There's no change in it. So that's great. So then I had to ask Dave Gardner, the mastering engineer, man, can you sneak these drums just a little bit? He was like, all right. You know, it's like,
that's really funny. So, now, how long was that process total from the time? Because I know there are clips on the internet, you guys playing, Sweet Disorder, for example, with almost completely different lyrics from 2015, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
How long was the whole sort of process, would you
it
say?
It was pretty, I mean, I started writing, I guess, probably in, 2014, okay. I guess, you know, and, I wrote Sweet Disorder with different lyrics for a 7-inch that we put out on Sub Pop. And then, man, it took a long time to write those songs. Then I think we started recording in February of 20. When was that? What year did we start recording it? Is it 20? No. It wasn't that soon, was it? Or was it 2016? 2016. Yeah, 2016.
Okay. Right at the beginning of that year.
Yes, right at the beginning of the year. And then we just, our buddy Jeremy, who we recorded with, his studio is called Battle Tape Studio, and it's in his house, and his wife was very ill and wound up kind of unexpectedly passing.
Oh, gosh.
As we were kind of near the end of cutting the record. And so it was really sad, and that the album's dedicated to her and their little girl. It was just everything from just outright tragedy to technical malfunctions were kind of going on with that record. And then it was definitely like a Leviathan.
but I
wound up like I'm happier with it than anything I've ever done, for sure. So
yeah.
Mountainous
You guys recorded live to tape, right? I mean, you just played songs, right?
Yep. That's right. And then, I mean, there were overdubs, like vocal overdubs, stuff like that. But why
is that important to you?
Well, I guess I just love the kind of sense of humanity that it lends to music. You know, it's like particularly now, like as it becomes easier and easier to like, I don't know, do it the quote correct way. You know what I mean? We're everything's to a metronome click and everything's tuned and pitched exactly and stuff. It's like, you know, there's something irreplaceable about records that are just people playing instruments, you know what I mean, to me. And with all the, you know, flaws and, you know, happy accidents, stuff like that. So
Well, I was telling Patrick earlier today that I hear a lot of different influences in there, but one thing I hear that I don't know if you've gotten this from anybody else, but I hear some Johnny Thunders.
Oh,
in your playing.
Awesome. Yeah.
And that's probably what it is, because it just feels like real. Like people are just playing. You know what I mean?
Totally. And our buddy Tim Kerr, who produces, he produced this Youth Detention and Dereconstructed, is very much of that mindset and ethos. Like that's a, he wants everybody in the room together playing, you know, and it's like, you have to, I mean, he will not bend on that. Like, he really won't. He's like, nah, he's like, even if, you know, if we're like, well, we only want one guitar on the song, he's like, he needs to be in there playing woodblock, something. Like, we need all of y'all in the room together, you know, like, because he's like, it's a conversation. It's people conversation with one another. And that's, and that's what drew me to his records, is they just sound so vital, you know, like all the stuff that he's produced. So
That's pretty cool. Are there other bands right now who've made records recently that you admire, where they got a sound that kind of inspired where you're coming from?
For that record? Man, I really love the way that Tenements records sound.
Okay.
Tenement's the one that kind of sticks out to me. That's, I mean, we're listening to a lot of different stuff from over the years, you know what I mean? But as far as more recent ones, that's the one that's
comes to your mind right away.
Yeah, that's coming to my
mind. Well, you must pick up a lot of stuff. Just as we're coming in here, I heard you having a conversation about a piece of guitar gear, right? Like, you must pick up a lot that way, just from being with bands that are, you know, playing in different cities and kind of hearing their live sounds too, right?
Definitely. Yeah. It's and that's something I've tried to learn more and more about, because that's not really my forte.
Equipment
and, like, you know, kind of technical. Like, I was always terrible at, you know, science and stuff like that. So it's like my brain just kind of shuts off at a certain point. It just stops making sense.
I can totally relate to that. When I used to play guitar, if it wasn't broken in some way or had something wrong with it, I didn't trust it. Like,
right,
it was
totally
wrong.
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to sound like I got it from Guitar Center. That's going to be bad.
Exactly.
You don't want that.
Don't want that.
No. Now, talking about touring, I think I saw a picture on Twitter. Did the van hit a 350,000 miles? Is that right? That's incredible.
It
so
did.
You guys are on the road a lot, right?
We're on
the
road.
Does it ever
get
exhausting?
Kind of. Yeah, it does at a certain time.
Right.
But I don't know. It's like usually right around, I think we're all about around a month 3.5 weeks is we're pretty tapped out.
Starts
ready
to get a little fried. Yeah.
Yeah. Just ready to go home. And, yeah. You know, but at the same time, it's like, you know, when I'm at home working my job.
Yep.
You know, what after that? After
what
about
is
a
that
month.
Job? What do you do when you're home?
For the last year and a half or so, it's been like a construction job.
Okay, cool.
And
gives you the freedom to take time off.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense.
And that's, yeah, I mean, that's sort of, I guess we're all kind of fortunate that we've figured out ways to do that.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, it's like, that's what I've been doing the last year and a half or so.
Yeah.
So.
Well, if you ain't playing, you're paying, right? Didn't Mike Watt say that?
That's so true.
Exactly right.
That's so true.
Yeah. So, you know, Lee, I read something recently that you were talking about people that you come across whose personal ethics don't necessarily square with the way they behave.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand a little? Did I get that right in sort of that sense?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
I think you were talking about somebody who in private would sort of make racist jokes, but then, you know, in public would do something that's sort of like philanthropic and, you know, much, much more outwardly, you know,
right.
appear to be, you know, very inclusive.
Right.
Yeah. Is there something about that appeals to you specifically or?
Well, I think what's interesting to me is how, I guess, like, morality is framed in, like, political context. So that, like, I think the story you're talking about was somebody I knew growing up who would say, like, racist stuff, make racist jokes. He, you know, he may have admitted to being a racist.
Yeah.
But it's like the way that he behaved in his community did not match the way he seemed to think. So that like he, you know, it's like he was in a primarily black neighborhood and was like, just like a really good neighbor and helped out a lot of the neighborhood kids who didn't have much or didn't have parents around and stuff. And it's like, that's just such a fascinating dissonance and like thing to square for me because at the same, I've known plenty of people that go the other way.
Yeah,
you know what
right,
I mean? Who,
right.
who say everything quote correct and do whatever, but it's like, they don't have a fucking, you know, moment to spare for somebody that's having a hard time.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so, that's something that's always kind of, confused me and intrigued me about, you know, a lot of the folks where we're from. And it's to me, I guess, like what I kind of feel called to do is to reframe some of these questions that are presented as political questions, as moral questions, mm-hmm. because a lot of these folks that I grew up around really do the right thing and they try to do the right thing. But when these questions become politicized, the question of right and wrong isn't really present in that conversation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's like,
yeah, totally.
And I think that's really what the civil rights movement showed us, you know, in the South is that, no, you know, Jim Crow is not a political question. It's a moral question. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like our most fundamental texts and ideals speak very directly to this. It transcends ideology.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so that was part two of the interview with Lee Baines.
Mm-hmm. It was great to hear about how they made that record, Youth Detention, and how hard they worked on it and some of the things that happened during the recording. Yeah. Something, it's very special.
A double album, too.
I know, it's amazing.
And I bought a copy.
You did?
Yeah, at the show.
Yeah.
And so I have the vinyl.
The only thing that puzzles me about this, and we forgot to ask Lee, is why is it on pink vinyl? It would seem like the last color that he would associate with.
Right.
Maybe that's what he's doing. Maybe it's trying to, you know, the stereotypes don't mean anything
that's
to
right.
me. Right. Yeah, here's a pink vinyl. Yeah. Probably could have done it on rainbow. He would have done that if he could have. Yeah.
But again, I think one time we had a conversation not too long ago about whether I consider a band, you know, what format I think is the right,
that's right,
for the sort of band or whatever. And this is a vinyl band. This
vinyl
is
band? Definitely without a vinyl band. No,
yes,
question.
Yeah.
Yep. Hands down.
Okay. Tomorrow we're going to hear part three
of
the interview. Some really good stuff on that one. And so you're not going to want to miss that. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. You, of course, are already listening
every day.
Every day. Uh-huh. And you will find the show on all the big podcast platforms. And let us know what you think about Lee Bain's music or anything music related. Call
612-440-1984
or email rock@suburbspod.com or hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram @suburbspod, or, you know, stick your head out the window and yell. I almost screwed it up there.
Please.
I kind of screwed it up. And Lee, if you want to, you know, ever call, talk some more, just give us a ring.
Anytime. Right? Our door is open.
All right. So let's move on to tomorrow, part three. Mm-hmm. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foss.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.
I feel like we're all just like, wait, what? What's happening? How does this work?
Exactly.
How do you manage the, you know, it's like, it's pretty amazing.